presented by the Space Association of Australia. In today's program, Space Insurance, the Space Shuttle Atlantis Flies, and Space Station Freedom. Good afternoon, I'm Jeff Alshon. This is the second program in a new series presented, this time every second Sunday. The Space Show is about space news and interviews from Australia and overseas.
We often hear of satellites failing or rockets exploding. These represent an enormous loss to their owners. Can this loss be insured? Andrew Rennie spoke to Mr. Kirby Eichen of GIO Reinsurance in his Sydney office.
Can you actually insure a satellite?
Yes, most certainly. Satellite, just as with any other piece of property or equipment, is valuable to its owner and in this case is producing a stream of income, and hence it has to be insured to make sure that somebody doesn't go out of business if it fails. Basically, you can insure a satellite when it's being launched, when it's being tested in orbit, or when it's actually in orbit. And in fact, GIO insures all of those phases of a satellite's lifetime.
So our Australian companies are actually involved in insuring overseas satellites?
GIO is actually one of the 10 biggest in the world in terms of the net insurance. I won't try to explain the term net, but suffice it to say that we carry a fairly substantial portion of a satellite while it's in orbit, or the risk associated with it.
So every time we read in the newspaper or hear on Southern FM about a Ariane exploding, for example, you've lost some money?
In fact, we did. We were insuring one of the Japanese satellites on the Ariane failure last year. Fortunately, we didn't lose too much money on that because the Japanese tend to insure their own satellites very much themselves. Satellite business is a very international business, with satellites costing up to $150 million, in fact even more than that in some cases, you'll find that no one satellite is insured by one insurance company. In fact, you'll have dozens of companies insuring the one satellite, and hence a company like GIO might take a couple of million dollars or several million dollars off that $150 million. In the case of the Japanese satellites, it was mostly taken up by the Japanese market.
So very much like shipping insurance.
Yes, that's right. No one company could afford to bear $150 million loss in one go, not on something as specific as satellites, because there are very few of them launched. It doesn't give you a good spread of risks. And it's fairly difficult to have good statistics on satellite launches. I mean, there are very much fewer of them than there are of cars or ships.
So what is the launch failure rate? For example, if you're insuring in the launch phase, what's the approximate failure rate at the moment?
I guess we'd say in a generic sense it's about 12%. That varies from vehicle to vehicle. The Delta is probably the best of the lot, has the best success rate. Of course, you never believe the manufacturer's failure rates because they're always taking into account more things than an insurer would, but the Delta would be the best. Ariane is probably the second best. The Atlas is probably the third. Of course, if you want to look at the Zenit, which is the proposed vehicle for Cape York, it's probably got the best flight rate of any of the launch vehicles, though of course it's never been launched. It's never been used to launch commercial satellites, and it's never been launched in the version that would be used at Cape York.
I see. And can satellite operator buy insurance for the separate phases of the operations, launch, in-orbit operations and check-out, and then finally the operational phase, or do they have to buy the whole lot at once?
It's usually separated into two phases, one which is called the launch cover, which will be from intentional ignition of the rocket through till the end of the in-orbit commissioning of the satellite, and that means the launch phase is until the satellite is separated and put from its launcher and put into orbit. there's then usually a 180-day test period, and you'll find that that entire period from intentional ignition through to the end of the commissioning will be one launch cover, and then the in-orbit phase will be insured separately, usually on a year-to-year renewable basis. And of course you'll find that the satellite may not be insurable for its entire life, and hence as it gets closer to the end of its life, people won't be as willing to insure it.
And does every commercial satellite operator take out insurance, or do some just take their own risk?
These days, most companies would take out insurance. A couple of years ago, the insurance rates were much higher, around the 25% and closer to 30% rates, which is 30% of the insured value of the satellite. Once the rates got up to that point, a lot of satellite operators were simply deciding it wasn't worthwhile insuring their satellites. Intelsat is another example of a company that doesn't, or consortium perhaps is a better term, that doesn't insure its satellites. Although having had one failure last year, they have now been looking at partial insurance, and some of the countries that make up Intelsat are insuring while others aren't. So it's kind of a hybrid.
So Intelsat operates, what, 20, 30 satellites?
It may well have done that in its lifetime. I'm not sure how many would be operational at the moment. I think they tend to buy constellations of 5 to 7 satellites at a time. So I surmise that are how many would be in orbit at once.
And the organisation itself doesn't take out insurance, but individual countries can.
That's right. In the past, it has taken a basic decision not to insure, but given the failure of the last satellite, or the failure of it to be placed into orbit correctly, they have suggested to some of their member countries that they might like to take out insurance. Now, most of those countries have decided not to, and we're seeing maybe 25% of the value of the satellite actually being insured.
Right. And this Intelsat satellite that failed, the most recent failure, is the one that was launched on a Titan commercial.
That's right.
Failed to separate from the vehicle initially, and is now in a low Earth orbit, and it's going to be the first recovery mission for the new Space Shuttle Endeavour.
That's right. In fact, it's been a very interesting insurance placement because it's quite different to anything else that we've seen in the past. It's, I think, worth about $140 million, the insurance package. That would be the insured value of the satellite. As I say, only 25% of that is being taken up. But it's quite different what we're being asked to insure there. There are a lot of different risks associated with it. Not only is there the risks associated with the shuttle in manoeuvring around the satellite and the people working near it, but the satellite is also in orbit being exposed to the hazards of space for a year before it's being refurbished or relaunched, and nobody really knows what might happen to the satellite during that time. So it is quite an unusual insurance placement.
So in general terms then, just take that as a particular example, how would an insurer go about assessing the risk of such an operation?
That's a very good question. In our case, we're not what they call a lead underwriter. There will be a lead underwriter somewhere around the world, usually London or the US, and that particular lead underwriter will be the one who sets the terms and the conditions and the rate of the policy. And we don't have a great deal of say then in determining what kind of rate, and hence we just follow the market. That doesn't mean to say that we're ignorant about how the market is, or the rate is assessed. Obviously we need to know, have our own sort of feeling for things. In some cases it's more of a gut feeling for how something is done. You can't put a specific figure on any one component of the risk. The shuttle, you know, has a specific failure rate. Most of the other hazards, you really just have to take a stab in the dark almost, based on our own knowledge of the industry, the kind of things that are involved in it. I really can't say anything more specific than that.
Okay. And what about our own national satellite operator, AusSat? Did they take out insurance for their initial AusSat A series? And do they intend to take out insurance on their AusSat B series, which is due for launch
early next year, I think? Yes, in both cases they took out insurance on the first generation, and in fact it was the first generation of OSAT satellites that brought us into the market. We were the leaders on the Australian leaders on the first generation of OSAT satellites, and we would hope to be again for the second generation. We have recently looked at the insurance package for OSAT. It's a little bit different in that Hughes, the manufacturer of the satellites, place insurance on a number of their satellites. So there's one insurance placement being done by Hughes, and there is also an additional package of insurance being done specifically for OSAT, and we would give our maximum insurance line to the OSAT satellites. In fact, they will be the biggest risk that we have taken to date.
I understand that at the time that OSAT left the contract for the B series, that it was a rather unusual purchase, and that it was purchased in orbit. Most satellites until then had been bought on the ground, and then the new owner of the satellite had then taken the risk of launching it. But in GALSAT's case, they're buying it in orbit, is that correct?
That's right. It was, as I recall, the first instance anywhere in the world of that happening. The satellite is essentially, as you say, purchased in orbit rather than from the manufacturer, and hence the risk of getting the satellite into orbit really rests more with the satellite manufacturer and the launch vehicle manufacturer than it does with OSAT. Nevertheless, OSAT does have other expenses which it needs to cover, and that's why we have these sort of two insurance policies covering the one satellite: the Hughes package, which covers the launch and getting it up to orbit, and then the extra expenses which OSAT might incur being the second coverage.
Not least of which would be loss of income.
Loss of income. There are also some other costs associated with purchasing a new satellite. It's a somewhat unusual arrangement that Hughes produced sort of the basic spare spacecraft, but they don't build it completely to OSAT's requirements. It's there on the production line in case somebody else needs it, and there would be extra costs in bringing that satellite up to the capabilities required by OSAT.
And the OSAT B series is going to be launched by a Chinese vehicle, the Long March 2E. Now, does that present you with any particular problems?
That's another interesting question. Last year we had the first commercial launch of a satellite on a Long March, and that was the AsiaSat 1 satellite. Now, strangely enough, that particular launch was heavily oversubscribed by insurers, indicating that they had a great deal of confidence in the vehicle, or that they felt very comfortable with the insurance rate being offered. And given that the rate being offered wasn't really that much higher than the going rate, I think it indicates that most of the insurers in the world are fairly comfortable with it. I should point out, though, that the AsiaSat was a refurbished satellite, and hence there was a slightly greater risk with the satellite itself. But nevertheless, I think it shows that there was a good level of confidence in the Long March vehicle, and I think that'll be reflected again with the OSAT placement.
Well, for the sake of your business, Kirby, we'll hope that all goes well in the space business, and we don't have any of those dramatic headlines that newspapers seem to love. Thank you very much for joining us today on Southern FM.
It's a pleasure, Andrew.
I recorded that interview with Kirby Eichen of GIO Reinsurance about 3 weeks ago. I expressed the hope that there would be no untoward events which might result in a claim against the space insurance industry. Unfortunately, it appears that hope may be destroyed. On April the 5th, a European Ariane space rocket blasted off from the Kourou Space Centre, French Guiana. On board was the Canadian communications satellite ANIC-E2. All went well, with the satellite successfully reaching its required orbit some 36,000 kilometres above the equatorial South America. But then things began to go wrong. The satellite weighs 3 tonnes. I have on the line Martin Kirkby of the Australian Space Insurance Group. Good afternoon, Martin.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
Well, Martin, what happened to ANIC-E2?
Well, as you know, the launch was entirely successful on the Ariane. It was the Launch 43, and that was on the 4th of April. and then we were advised last week that there were problems with the deployment of its main communications antennae. We don't have a great deal of information at the moment, but we, of course, it is a very serious problem if they can't manage to unfold it totally. And so we're waiting for more news. We have been told that they have been partially successful in extending it, and we're going to wait till next week to see if they can, if this actually happens. It is, as you know, a very large sum insured of $280 million, of which we have a small percentage, and therefore it's, I mean, it's a critical risk for the space insurance industry as a whole.
The $218 million insurance covers what?
Well, that's the sum insured, the agreed sum insured for the satellite. It's probably more than its true value, in fact, because they tend to want to cover sort of all aspects of the satellite and other expenses as well. So, but it is one of the largest values that has ever been insured.
I see. What was the next largest insurance loss that's been made in the industry?
Well, only recently, a month ago, the space insurance market paid out $170 million US on Superbird A satellite, which was an in-orbit failure. This satellite lost most of its oxidizer and fuel and had to be deorbited just after Christmas. Now, that was the largest single loss so far on a satellite. And as I say, it's only been paid within the last month. And if we had another loss of, even considerably more in this case, then it would be very bad news for the market worldwide.
How long had Superbird A been in operation before it failed?
I think it went up in mid-1989. So not very long. In fact, the initial insurance for it was launch plus 12 months, and then they introduced an orbit policy, which began, I think, in June last year. And on in-orbit policies, they normally decrease month by month in value, and at the time of the loss, it was $170 million. So, I mean, that was by far the largest amount that had ever been paid out on a single satellite.
So this Japanese satellite had been operating for, best part of half a year before it failed?
Well, about 18 months.
About 18 months.
Yeah.
And this current satellite we're now talking about, Einiki 2, hasn't yet been put into operation, has it?
No, not at all. I mean, it was only launched on the 4th of April, so it was undergoing, it wasn't even undergoing tests because its main antenna, as we know, haven't been fully extended yet, or at least we're not aware that they have. So we're just waiting to see. If it was a total failure, total loss, then it would just remain up there. There's nothing anybody can do to recover it in a geostationary orbit, which is, as you know, 36,000 miles out, kilometres out, I should say.
Yes, in our previous interview, we talked about a satellite which had failed and was going to be recovered from the shuttle. Obviously, this can't be done, can it, or with this one?
No. Geostationary satellites are far beyond the current range of the shuttle, which is a low Earth orbit of 200 kilometres or thereabouts. The satellites which have been recovered from by the shuttle in the past have been ones which haven't reached their full geostationary height and therefore been within range of the shuttle, which is not the case in Franek 2. So there's no question of using the shuttle on this one. It's either the Earth stations manage to extend the antennae by whatever means they have available, or if they can't do that, then there's nothing really to be done. And it would be a total loss, of course.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the Space Show. Thank you, Martin.
You're very welcome, Andrew. Goodbye.
Bye.
In our last program, we heard about the launch of the Space Shuttle Atlantis. Andrew Rennie has been following this mission.
Two astronauts from the crew of the orbiting space shuttle Atlantis made an unscheduled spacewalk Sunday, the first extravehicular activity in the U.S. space program in more than 5 years. VOA's Gary Treadway reports the astronauts freed a stuck communications antenna on the $600 million Gamma Ray Observatory, which was then released into its planned orbit.
Astronauts Jerry Ross and Jay App were scheduled to make a spacewalk on Monday and had been preparing for it. They were standing by Sunday in case there was a problem with the deployment of the Gamma Ray Observatory. The high-gain communications antenna on the observatory failed to extend in response to repeated commands from the ground. Astronauts Ross and Apt, wearing their special pressurized spacesuits, opened the hatch and went to the rescue. 17 minutes later, astronaut Ross freed the stuck antenna used for communicating scientific data back to Earth, and the Gamma Ray Observatory was sent on its way. The observatory will orbit 450 kilometers above the Earth for at least 2 years, gathering information on gamma radiation, which scientists hope to use to unlock secrets about the origin of matter and the universe. The two Atlantis astronauts remained outside the spacecraft for 3 hours, performing some of the experiments they were scheduled to carry out during their spacewalk on Monday. Astronauts Ross and Apt will leave Atlantis again Monday to continue the experiments to test equipment and techniques astronauts will be using to construct the space station Freedom later this decade. Some of the experiments involve the simple task of tightening bolts with a wrench so engineers can learn how such operations can best be accomplished in the weightlessness of space. They will also experiment with different methods for propelling a cargo sled on a monorail, used to transport workers and equipment from one end of the large space station to another. The 17-ton Gamma Ray Observatory, its stubborn antenna prodded into place during Sunday's unscheduled spacewalk, is now orbiting the Earth, preparing to start collecting information about gamma radiation. Astronauts Ross and Apt are resting following their walk in space and are getting ready to do it again a few hours from now. Gary Treadway, Voice of America, Miami.
Release of the observatory, which is worth $787 million Australian, came on the third day of the mission. Jay Apt described being able to help put the observatory into orbit as a very satisfying thing for the whole crew. The next day, the crew made another spacewalk. This time, it was a planned one. The objective was to test various techniques to be used in the construction of the space station. Again, the VOA.
Two U.S. astronauts are conducting their second walk in space in 2 days, clad in bulky white pressurized suits and oxygen backpacks, and tethered to the shuttle Atlantis. Jerry Ross and Jay Apt are in the Atlantis cargo bay testing equipment and techniques for building a space station.
The crew of Atlantis spent what was planned as the final day using an amateur radio rig to talk to amateur radio operators around the world, including some in Australia. They also performed a number of minor experiments. When the time came to land, the crew got the wave off. Alan Silverman of the VOA explains why.
Two times Atlantis was maneuvered into position for the rocket firing to slow it from orbital speed. Both times, however, the shuttle was waved off and told to stay in space because of weather down here on the ground. Despite crystal clear skies over the Mojave Desert, winds blowing across the two units were out of NASA's limits for a safe shuttle landing. NASA spokesman Don Haley says the crew has food and oxygen for several days beyond the planned 5-day flight.
They've got enough consumables to stay up for a couple of days, and if the weather conditions are not favorable tomorrow, they could look at it for a Friday landing.
Spokesman Haley adds that Atlantis could be brought into Kennedy Space Center in Florida, but weather conditions there are not favorable for a Thursday landing. A delay till Friday would put Atlantis on the ground 10 years to the day since Columbia blasted off on the first U.S. shuttle flight. Alan Silverman, VOA News, Edwards Air Force Base in California.
as things turned out, the Atlantis was able to make a landing the next day at the Edwards Air Force Base. The next shuttle mission is to be the launch of the Discovery on Tuesday, a little after 9 o'clock Australian time. This will be followed by the Columbia on May the 25th. The Discovery payload is quite a large and varied one, largely devoted to military experiments. The crew will consist of Michael Coates as commander, Blaine Hammond Jr. as pilot, Gregory Harbour as mission specialist, Donald McGonigal, Guyon Bluford, Lacey Veach and Richard Habe as mission specialists. As Alan Silverman pointed out in his report, the landing of Atlantis marked the 10th anniversary of the first launch of the space shuttle. During those 10 years, 39 shuttle missions have been flown. Each of those missions has been controlled from on board the shuttle by 5 general purpose computers. Now you may not believe this, but in all those 10 years, those computers have never been upgraded. There have been many reasons for this, including the worry that if they change the software, something might not be quite right and it might cause a disaster. However, at long last, they've gotten around to updating the computers.
What's happened?
Tuesday's flight, then, will be the first, carrying 5 new general-purpose computers. These have a mass of only 30 kilograms, but have an amazing memory capacity of 262,000 words. They can compute data at 1 million instructions per second, and yet they only consume 550 watts of power. One can only hope that these new computers are successful.
For some years now, the Soviet Union has been offering to fly foreign nationals to the Mir space station. The fare is a paltry $10 million or near offer. British, Austrian and German groups have reserved trips. A Japanese broadcasting company sent one of its employees on an 8-day jaunt last December. For a time, the American singer John Denver was planning to entertain Soviet cosmonauts aboard Mir. He withdrew when his wife became pregnant. Aerospace Ambassadors, a private United States-based organisation, has announced it will sponsor the flight of an American teacher to Mir in 1993. The teacher would undertake experiments on behalf of schools. And in news just to hand, the Soviet government has waived all charges on this flight.
Hands up to those who saw the film 2010, The Year We Made Contact. Remember that scene when the spaceship Leonov plunges into the atmosphere of Jupiter? The objective was to use friction to slow the craft, thereby saving rocket fuel. The technique is called aerobraking. The trick is a delicate balance between coming too close to the planet and burning up due to high heat, and passing too far away to be slowed down. This has never actually been done, at least not until mid-March, when the Japanese Hyten spacecraft, returning from the moon, dove through the Earth's atmosphere at an altitude of only 126 kilometres. This slowed Hyten by 6 kilometres an hour, reducing the high point of its orbit by 10,000 kilometres.
The Space Association of Australia is a non-profit, non-political group of space enthusiasts who are keen to learn about and share with others items of interest in the space program and outer space. Feedback from this program or general inquiries about the Space Association can be sent to us care of this station or at our address at Post Office Box 351, Mulgrave North 3170. That's PO Box 351, Mulgrave North 3170. Or you are invited to attend the next meeting of the Association, which is on Thursday the 2nd of May at 7:30 on the third floor of the YWCA building in Elizabeth Street in Melbourne.
I'm Jeff Olshon, and on behalf of myself, Mark Hillier, Andrew Rennie, John Coleman, Helena Roberts and all the members of the Space Association of Australia, I'd like to thank you for listening. We hope to enjoy your company again in a fortnight. You've been listening to The Space Show.